This is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Time for a little experiment. Now, this is something that I want you to try the next time you're at a dinner party. Ask if anyone at the table is kept awake by someone else's snoring. Yep, snoring. And here's what I predict will happen. There's going to be an awkward silence, and then a furtive glance exchanged between the couples at the table. And then quietly, one brave soul is going to confess to an occasional noisy night of snoring. Right after that, the floodgates are going to open because it seems like almost everyone shares a bedroom with someone else who is losing sleep or snoring, and they just can't get a good night's sleep. Somebody's snoring next to you in bed or another room or right there. It's one of the dirty little family secrets, but believe me, it's a big secret. By conservative estimates, as many as 60 to 70 million Americans snore. That's about one out of every three adults, one out of every three people snore, a large number. And assuming that their partners haven't moved into a separate bedroom yet, that means as many as 70 million Americans might be kept awake by that loud, home-wrecking sound of someone else's snoring. But what can you do? Well, you're bombarded with ads if you watch TV, ads all kinds of remedies on TV. What do you get? Those little strips of tape to put over your nose? They sell that in the drugstore. You got the acupressure ring. You can buy that on the internet. Then there are other alternatives like surgery. And how is snoring related to sleep apnea, waking up during sleep? We're going to talk about this and all the other things that have to do with snoring. We're going to sort it out for you. We're going to look at the treatments out there and ask you, if you snore, have you found something that works to stop it? Maybe you can tell us what you think is working for you or your experiences with snoring. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. As always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Dr. Mark W. Mehewald is a professor of neurology at the University of Minnesota and chair of the neurology at the Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis. He's also director of the Minnesota Regional Sleep Disorders Center there. He joins us by phone from his office. So thanks for being with us today, Doc.
This is my pleasure.
You're welcome. Captain Pete Michelson is a head and neck surgeon at the Wilford Hall Medical Center on Lackland Air Force Base. That's in San Antonio, Texas, and he joins us from the studios of KSTX in San Antonio. Thank you for talking with us today, Dr. Michelson.
No, it's a pleasure, Ira.
Let me ask you, Dr. Mehewald, is there a profile, is there an average snorer? Who snores, what age, what, you know, who are they? I said there was like 60, 70 million Americans. That's a lot of people.
Well, the prevalence of snoring in people over the age of 50 or 60 is about 40% in women and 60% in men, so it's extraordinarily high. It used to be thought it was primarily men and that women didn't snore very often because it's not considered to be very dainty. However, snoring is very, very prevalent in women. It's actually seen even in 10% of children. So snoring doesn't respect age, sex, body habitus, or age. So snoring can occur absolutely at any age, in either sex, and any body weight.
And that was my next question, because the mythology says usually it's overweight people who are doing the snoring.
Well, I think weight certainly plays a role in snoring. You're more apt to snore if you are overweight. If you snore, your snoring may get worse if you gain weight. But what's important to keep in mind is that many people who are very, very heroic snorers are not the least bit overweight. And conversely, many people who are severely overweight do not snore. So weight is a risk factor for, but certainly not the sole cause of snoring.
And let's talk about this, the cause of snoring. Is there one cause inside your throat that causes you to snore?
Well, there's one cause, and that is increased resistance of air moving through the upper airway. There's not one location in the upper airway, and that's why there are so many generally ineffective treatments that are available for snoring. It's axiomatic. The more treatments that are available for a given medical condition, the least apt any one of them is to be effective. I mean, if there were one good effective treatment for snoring, we wouldn't be bombarded by ads for 30 or 40 different purportedly effective treatments.
Dr. Mehewald, when someone comes into your clinic with complaints of snoring, what do you do? Is there a set of tests that you conduct?
Well, the first order of business is to make sure that the snoring is not one of the manifestations of obstructive sleep apnea, because that's a completely different issue in terms of treatment and in terms of medical consequences. Now, virtually all people who have sleep apnea snore. The converse is not true. The majority of people who snore do not have sleep apnea. So we ask about observed breath holding during sleep. We ask about symptoms of excessive daytime sleepiness. We ask about whether the individual has high blood pressure or heart trouble or diabetes. These can all be kind of indirect markers of obstructive sleep apnea. Now, the treatment for obstructive sleep apnea is generally going to be quite different from the treatment that we might recommend for snoring. So the first order of business is, does the snorer likely have obstructive sleep apnea? If the answer is yes, then that individual does need a formal sleep study to identify the presence and or severity of any underlying sleep and breathing problems.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Michelson, let's talk about how you treat people with surgery. Tell us about the different surgeries that there are for snoring.
Well, just as my sleep medicine colleague stated, the first order of business is to determine whether or not the patient comes in with simple snoring, or if the snoring is a symptom of a greater medical problem such as obstructive sleep apnea. After the proper evaluation has been done, our treatment basically is dependent upon that answer. Is if there is actually just snoring occurring, we have extremely effective either clinic or operating room procedures that a patient can undergo that have been time-proven in the literature to help snoring and to get rid of it. There's been sort of an evolution with sleep surgery. Now, if looking at old medical journals from London in the 1840s, even back then, obviously snoring's been a problem for a long time, but surgeons back then were trying to decrease the floppy palate in the patients that had a lot of heroic snoring and sleep apnea. After that, there was a long amount of time where there wasn't much that was not much in terms of evolution, but in the 80s or so in the U.S., a palatal procedure, uteral palatal pharyngioplasty, or UPPP, became very popular, in which part of the palate is cauterized and part of it is removed and the tonsils are removed. And that is a very destructive procedure, and it was created with the thought of curing snoring. What we've sort of moved on from there into is cure versus control and quality of life issues. Do you want to remove tissue or do you want to try to stiffen this palate? Now, this is mainly talking about patients that have snoring. What we see in patients that snore is that the palate, when they're sleeping, about 80 or so percent of folks where snoring arises, is floppy, like as if you would see if it were in a wind tunnel. And what we're trying to move towards are clinic-based procedures that are less painful and just as effective, where we stiffen the palate. And out of this idea was born procedures such as LAUP, or laser-assisted uveal palatoplasty, CAPSO, cautery-assisted palatal stiffening operation, the RFA treatments, or radiofrequency ablation, where we actually put a probe into the soft tissues and deliver energy, which creates scarring, and most lately, injection snoreplasty, where we actually inject a sclerosing agent of some sort into the palate for it to stiffen, and mostly recently, the pillar implant system, where small implants are actually placed into the palate, will stiffen it and thus decrease snoring.
Are these painful?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. The earlier procedures, such as a UPPP, if you you were talking earlier about the dinner table discussion,
right.
I can guarantee you that not only would snoring bring up a good discussion, but if anybody had undergone a UPPP, they will discuss their postoperative course because these are very painful. The typical way to perform this procedure is with cautery units, basically a hot stick that burns the tissue and removes it. And an average adult will have 1 to 2 weeks of intense post-op pain from this procedure. Now, the later procedures are different. These clinic procedures, such as injection snoreplasty, are much less painful. We see patients come in from work and go back to work that day or the next day.
Dr. Mayerwald, what do you think of these surgical techniques?
Well, I would be in pretty much agreement. Certainly, the best way to describe the results of uveal palatal pharyngoplasty with regard to discomfort is memorable. Most of these patients will say that it was a very significantly uncomfortable procedure. With regard to the palate procedures, one problem with snoring is that it can arise from multiple different levels of the upper airway, very rarely from the nasal passages, and that's why the nasal dilating strips tend to be ineffective because snoring is almost never coming from the nose per se. Mm-hmm. In many people, it is coming from the soft palate, in which case one of the palatal procedures may be effective. But many people's snoring is coming from the base of the tongue or even the lateral pharyngeal walls. So what people need to know is that if their snoring is coming purely from the soft palate, then one of the palatal procedures may be effective. What we don't know is how long these procedures are effective. And if we look at the uvula palatopharyngoplasty procedure as an example, the short-term effectiveness for snoring, again, this is not for sleep apnea, but for snoring, it was very, very high, 75-80%. However, after 4 years, 50% of the people are snoring again, which tells us that for many people, snoring is a progressive condition. It gets worse over time. And these procedures may buy some time in the progression of the underlying condition, but many of the palatal procedures, we don't have any long-term follow-up data. And I think that if the extreme procedure, like uvulopalatopharyngoplasty, shows a decrement in effectiveness over time, I think it's likely to suspect that the palate procedures may also. But again, we just don't know.
You agree, Dr. Mackelson, it's just a temporary fix?
Well, actually, that's true, and we actually have, in the ear, nose, and throat literature, we have, and as well as sleep literature, there are some studies that have followed UPPP patients out. When we start moving past the 3 to 5, we're actually past the 2 to 3 year mark, we start to see that the patients that had in moderate severe obstructive sleep apnea will often revert back to the same symptoms that they had before the surgery. However, the difference is now they don't have much of a palate, they don't have tonsils, and what do you do with that patient? And that's in addition to the additional problems that procedure can sometimes move those folks into when they try to have additional therapies such as continuous positive airway pressure. But that is exactly why the majority of otolaryngologists are moving towards the newer therapies, because the newer therapies are not designed to cure snoring. They are designed to control it. So you come in for, you know, your injection.
I'm going to have to have you hold that thought, because we have to take a break, but it's an interesting thought, and we want to flesh it out fully. So stay with us. We'll come right back and talk more about snoring. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about snoring and sleep apnea with my guest, Dr. Mark W. Mayowald, professor of neurology at the University of Minnesota, and Captain Pete Mackelson, head and neck surgeon at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. And when I rudely interrupted Dr. Mackelson, he was telling us about something that was, I was so sorry to hear about it, that the surgical techniques, he was saying, some of them don't work, and then you have to go on to the next stage that might be controlling, if not curing, the snoring.
Well, exactly. Some of these procedures came out, when the UP3 came out, there was so much excitement because it was so effective for snoring, and initially it helped a lot of the patients with apnea. But like I said, as we followed those patients out, a lot of them kind of wound up in the same boat that they were in when they came in for treatment initially. And the newer treatments that we have, now these are the treatments that I can offer as an ENT doc, such as the clinic-based procedures, the RFA, the palate and or tongue base, injection snoreplasty, the pillar system. These are designed to control snoring. They are designed to help stiffen the palate. Now, and that's a whole other discussion, where exactly is the snoring coming from? This is based on the fact that we know about 80% of the folks that come in with simple snoring, and that is snoring without apnea. The source, by and far, is the palate. So that's why a lot of our procedures are aimed at treating the palate. Mm-hmm. We can treat the palate in the clinic. It is associated with some discomfort, but
describe,
not a lot.
Describe what you're doing, what that pillar technique is.
Well, the pillar implant system is basically, it's a commercially made product. They're small implants that are basically, with a special implant device, are placed into the palate, into the soft tissue of the palate, in front of the uvula. And they're submucosal, so they're basically under the skin. And these implants, probably by a combination of the implant itself and the reaction to the implant in the soft tissues over time, will decrease the palatal flutter during sleep and decrease snoring.
So it doesn't eliminate the snoring, it controls the snoring, as you're saying.
Well, it depends, first of all, on the patient. And second of all, it is probably one of the newest devices out of the market. We're still awaiting. We have some data on the pillar implant system, which is multi-year. We're actually anxious to see the data that brings it out further, because there obviously are also some potential complications of all of these procedures, such as if you place a foreign body into the palate, your body's natural reaction is to get rid of that foreign body. And will it be spit out? Will you get an infection? Following these patients out long-term is something is data that I'm anxious to see. What we do know is that the efficacy... I'm sorry?
I'm particularly looking for long-term data from studies that are not sponsored by the pillar's manufacturer.
Exactly, and that's why, I mean, me speaking selfishly, some of the studies that I've done, now I have not studied pillar. I did help some of an earlier work with the pillar system, and did note that personally, my colleague and I, Eric Mayer, when we did some work back in Washington, D.C., had a problem with extrusion rates. We noticed that a lot of the implants we were placing were extruding. Now, this was before the implant and the device for implantation was redesigned with what we mm-hmm. gave as input to the company. But it's nice to be able to do studies when we're in the military, because we are not sponsored by anybody and we're just looking out for the best interest of the patient. I did study some other commercial snoring aids in the past, and in working and using all of these methods in the clinic, they seem to be somewhat equally comparable in efficacy. And if the patient, such as the injection snoroplasty or RFA, gets treated, the thought is if they recur in 2 to 3 years, they can come back in, get another treatment, go back to work that day, and sort of like come in and get a booster shot for snoring. That's kind of where I foresee it going.
Does it affect your swallowing or your voice or things like that?
Well, probably the most common complaint that we'll see, and once again, it's very procedure specific, but we will see complaints of dysphagia or difficulty, or my swallowing is a little bit different. Somewhat of a transient symptom we do see in the majority of the patients that get some of these procedures is due to the swelling that happens in the palate. Very small amount of swelling in the mouth will be perceived as anybody as difficulty swallowing, but it tends to go away with time, and it's transient.
You might not want to do this on an opera singer.
Exactly, and obviously, all the patients that come in after they're properly evaluated, and that includes not only an objective test such as a polysomnogram, but our own physical examination, we speak to them about the risks and benefits. And to be honest, even if we affect the voice of an opera singer, which these procedures would not, how much is their life being affected by them not sleeping at night, or their spouse moving to a separate room for the past 10 years?
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Mike in Minneapolis. Hi, Mike.
Hello there.
Hi.
I've had a problem with snoring for many years, and I've hit upon something that works for me, and that is a set of exercises that I do after brushing my teeth and before going to bed at night. I do an exaggerated yawn. I work the muscles at the back of my throat and the base of my tongue, and my wife tells me that when I do those exercises regularly, I don't snore. When I, forget to do them, go without doing them for several days, then things go lax and I start snoring again. Is there any studies done on the effect of exercises such as that?
Dr. Meyerwald?
I'm not personally aware of any, and although the idea is attractive, one of the problems with waking muscle exercises, you may strengthen muscles during wakefulness, but sleep is associated with a dramatic change in muscle control, and many muscles actually lose all of their strength during our sleep, particularly dream sleep. And so if snoring were to occur during dream sleep, then muscle strengthening exercises would be completely sabotaged by the REM sleep.
What led me to this was I was wondering, what is the purpose of a yawn?
Why do we yawn in general?
Yeah, it's to get oxygen or what have you, but also there's this exaggerated stretching motion that we go through.
Again, I'm not aware of any good studies that have really specifically addressed the effect of any upper airway muscle exercises or muscle strengthening exercises on snoring. It may be that it's effective, but I'm not aware of any studies.
Mike, if it works for you, do it.
I think one thing we haven't talked about, very non-invasive treatment and one that is often very effective, is a mandibular advancement device. These are completely non-invasive. These look like hockey tooth guards, and they basically are fitted to each person's mouth specifically or individually, and they serve to jut the lower jaw forward. And they have adjustment screws so you can progressively protrude the lower jaw. And what that does is that the base of the tongue is a attached to the lower jaw. And so as you move the lower jaw forward, the base of the tongue is moved forward. And for the people whose snoring is not coming from the palate region, but rather is coming from the base of the tongue region, this may be very effective. And in the hands of the dentists that we've worked with for the last 25 years with this, their success rate in snoring, again, this is not apnea. I think everybody should know that what we're talking about today is snoring and not apnea, is about 75 or 80%. And this is just completely non-invasive. If it works, fine. If it doesn't work, there's no harm done.
What about these CPAP masks that I hear so many people wearing? Describe what they're used for.
Well, CPAP is a treatment for obstructive sleep apnea. It's spelled CPAP, and that stands for continuous positive airway pressure. It's simply a mask that typically goes over the nose and not the mouth, and is attached to a blower that blows in room air, not oxygen, just room air, and it serves as a simple mechanical splint to keep the upper airway open. And it is used for people who have obstructive sleep apnea, and it's effective in virtually everybody. Now, some people have trouble tolerating it, but it is very, very effective. It will eliminate snoring and obstructive sleep apnea because it eliminates or reduces the resistance to the airflow going through the upper airway. I don't know what my colleagues' experience is with this, but for snoring, I don't think that we have 15,000 people using CPAP from our sleep center who had using it for apnea. I don't believe we have anyone who's using it solely for snoring. I think that the CPAP is cumbersome enough and uncomfortable enough that there has to be a bigger payoff to the patient, and usually the patients who have obstructive sleep apnea have severe excessive daytime sleepiness, which is almost immediately treated by using nasal CPAP. So they have a payoff, and they feel much better the next day. Uh-huh. For snoring without any other symptoms, I think it's unlikely that people will wear CPAP on a regular basis.
Dr. Michelson, what about some of these over-the-counter devices we've been seeing, the nose strips? I actually saw a popular one on the web these days, which is an acupressure ring. Are you familiar with these? And do we know if they work or not? It's a ring you put on your pinky, I think, and there's an acupressure point it says that will stop you from snoring, complete with testimonials.
Exactly, and that's mainly all you're going to get with many of these products. I was called from USA Today recently to ask my opinion on the ring. That was the first I had heard of it because there's no way, even as a physician, I mean, you can't become familiar with all of the remedies that are out there. There's 500-plus commercially made snoring remedies that are basically in reference with the U.S. Trade and Patent Office right now. That's 500 plus. This is a multi-billion-dollar industry. This is an industry that promises that it's going to cure. And this is without a filter of a physician looking at a patient. So a patient won't know exactly where their problem is, but they'll be told that this thing will cure it. So often they'll go out and buy it. And I'm bombarded all day long in clinic with patients asking me if these things work. On an average clinic day, seeing approximately 50 to 60 patients, probably 10 or 20 are going to come in with questions about snoring or sleep apnea. In the other, you know, one half will walk in, the other half will be dragged in by their spouse and won't admit that they do when their spouse asks me about it. But many of them, the vast majority, have already tried many of these aids. And so a few years ago, I kind of set out to determine if some of these work. Now, I could in no way examine all of the possible remedies. And scientifically, to figure out which ones to study didn't seem like the way to go either. So what I did was I started asking patients what they had tried. I went on the web and looked at what popped up when I typed in a Google search engine for snoring. And I went to the local drugstore and I looked what was on the shelves and what was expensive and inexpensive and what was there the most of. And I finally decided, myself and Eric Merrier, this colleague of mine at Wolfert Hall Medical Center, decided to study three main categories. One was the lubricating mouth spray. Second was the nasal dilator strips, and third were the head positioning pillows. And what I did was I took these three products. I had 40-plus patients at my medical center that enrolled in this study. And then I took a week for each patient. Now, each patient had 7 independent sleep tests. That was every night for a full week, where I had them wear one of the devices one night and no device the next night. So basically, each patient was their own control. I also had the patients, as well as their bed partner, fill out subjective questionnaires as far as whether these devices worked. Now, of note, the sleep test test that I used was a home sleep test. It's called the SNAP test. And one of the benefits of using this particular type of polysomnogram is it also utilizes, it studies the acoustics of the sounds of your snore when you sleep. So not only can it give us an idea of the presence of apnea, but it can also give us an idea based on the frequency and duration of your snore, tell us possibly where the snore is coming from. Is it coming from palate? Is it coming from your tongue base? And we looked at all this data and went through the statistician at our medical center and found that none of these devices worked, period. None of them. And that was not only the objective sleep data, but the subjective questionnaires with the patients, asking the patients, would you use this again? Spouses, would you have your spouse use this again? And then I asked them problems that they had with these devices. Now, unfortunately, most of these devices are already been utilized when you discover that they're not working. Now, for some people, they might, but objectively, we looked at it and they did not. And what I envision doing and I hope will be done is further studies on the more available commercial products. But it's very disheartening. It's very disheartening for me to see that many of the folks that come in don't know that there are excellent options given that can be given to them by the pulmonologist, neurologist, or ENT doc that can cure the snoring problem. And instead, sometimes they go straight to the drugstore.
That's the sort of study we need. I'm familiar with that study, and it was a very, very nicely done study. And what we need are objective studies and not Oral Roberts testimonials. And, you know, despite the fact that this information is now in the medical literature, those devices are still widely purchased by people, which underscores the fact that snoring really is a big problem, and people will do just about anything, even if it doesn't make sense or even if we know it doesn't work, because they hope it'll work. They'll do anything to treat their snoring.
We're talking about snoring and sleep apnea this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And if you have a snoring problem and you don't know it, you might be having a sleep apnea problem, and that can be dangerous, right?
Right.
Why is that dangerous?
Well, again, sleep apnea is a kind of an extreme form of snoring where the resistance becomes so great that the airway actually closes, and the individual is trying to move air and is unable to, and then what terminates the breath-holding spell is a very brief arousal. It's just enough to open the airway, not enough to actually awaken the individual. And that allows the individual to take a few deeper breaths, but as soon as he or she falls deeper asleep again, this just happens repeatedly. And many people with sleep apnea stop breathing anywhere between 50 and 100 times an hour, completely unbeknownst to them. So this has two major consequences. One is it makes them too sleepy during the day, and that's because of the fragmentation of their sleep. So they will present with the complaint of falling asleep inappropriately during the day without apparent reason because, again, they are completely unaware, astonishingly unaware of the fact that they stop breathing 50 or 100 times an hour.
Some people have told me they've been at a traffic light and just fall asleep.
If you look at motor vehicle crashes, fall asleep crashes kill more young Americans under the age of 26 than alcohol-related crashes. So, fall asleepiness and driving is a very serious problem. And people with apnea, and there have been studies on this, are 7 to 8 times more apt to have fall asleep crashes than people without apnea. So it's serious from a public safety standpoint. The other consequence is related to the fall in the blood oxygen level, which happens during the breath-holding spell. And over many years, this very clearly can result in problems with high blood pressure, heart trouble, and diabetes. So the socioeconomic consequences of sleepiness and the medical consequences of hypertension, diabetes, and heart disease underscore the fact that obstructive sleep apnea is indeed a very serious condition, and it's so easy to treat. All you do is put nasal CPAP on, you put and blow air in their nose, it splints the upper airway open, and it completely eliminates the snoring and the apnea.
But you have to get used to this device, right?
You do, and there is some getting used to it. But again, as I mentioned earlier, the majority of people with sleep apnea have very unpleasant symptoms during the day, namely severe daytime sleepiness. And just after a couple nights of wearing this, their sleepiness is virtually gone. This completely eliminates sleep apnea. And they usually find that they feel so much better during the day that they are, happy to wear the CPAP at night. Plus, it stops the snoring, so their bed partners are happy.
Is there a cutting edge, so to speak, someplace in snoring research? Is there some magic device you'd like to have that, if you could have it, or if you knew about how to do this, or you knew how the air was going this way, you could fix something you couldn't?
Well,
Dr. Mackelson?
Hey, I'm a guy. I'll leave that to him. He knows more about this than I do.
I'll ask Dr. Mackelson. But we got a minute till the break, but go ahead.
I guess the magic device I would want is the ability to tell everybody to get a real evaluation. And because there are treatments, and there are treatments that folks don't even know are out there. So if we had the opportunity to speak to everybody and examine everybody, I think we could really make a dent in this, especially obviously I'm talking more about the snoring.
Yeah. I'd like to see a device that would allow us to identify where the snoring is coming from in a given individual, because then we could more accurately tailor our specific treatment recommendations.
Mm-hmm. All right, stay with us. We're going to have to take a short break when we come back. Lots of folks on the phones. You know they're all snoring out there, and hopefully not during Science Friday. But stay with us. We'll be right back and take some of your phone calls. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about snoring and sleep apnea this hour with Dr. Mark Mayowald and Captain Pete Mickelson. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Jamie in Medford, Oregon. Hi, Jamie.
Yes, hi, Ira.
Hi, go ahead.
This, I know, will not apply to everyone, but it has worked for me. When I was younger, I did not snore. Now I'm 50 years old, and I've been told I do snore. And basically how I found out was my partner, she rolled me over onto my side because I'd been sleeping on my back. Evidently, when I was younger, I was sleeping on my side. I'd like to ask your guests whether the position of the body could work. I basically used a home remedy. I used a pillow between my knees so I wouldn't roll over onto my back when I was sleeping. And what would you like to say about that?
Interesting. Dr. Mayowald, does one position work?
For almost all people, snoring, if it's going to progress over time, it initially is present only when you're lying on your back. Then it might spread to when you're lying on your back or your side, and then it assumes it's present in all positions. And probably the most extreme form is for people, if they fall asleep sitting up, they snore sitting up, and those people probably have sleep apnea. So clearly position is very, very important. Now, early on, what many people tried to do is they would try to keep people sleeping off their backs. And so one of the earliest treatments was just sewing tennis balls in the back of the jammy top. And so if you rolled over on your back, you'd be uncomfortable and then roll off your back onto your side of your stomach. That works occasionally, but what usually happens is people are going to sleep in whatever position they want to sleep in, and if they want to sleep on their back, they're going to sleep on their back even with the tennis balls there, or the tennis balls are going to keep them awake and they're not going to be able to sleep at all. So position is important, but it's been very, very difficult to find a device that will or a technique that will keep people from sleeping on their backs if they snore predominantly in that position.
And we're running out of time, but I have one final question. We've been hearing recently about the proliferation of sleeping pills, more and more people taking sleeping aids before they go to sleep. Does it affect the quality of your sleep, and does it lead to more snoring or less snoring, or do we not know?
First of all, there are a lot of now very, very effective sleeping medications, and I personally am all for it because I think the complaint of insomnia has been overlooked and ignored for a long period of time. We have medications that are very, very effective for inducing sleep. The newer ones should have absolutely no effect upon snoring. Some of the older ones and alcohol actually will make snoring worse. Alcohol, even very small amounts of alcohol in certain individuals make snoring much worse. But the newer sleeping medication should have no effect on snoring.
Dr. Mickelson, you agree?
I wholeheartedly agree. Actually, listening to Jamie's comment, the caller there, he actually hit on a point that I'd read about in the past where, the treatment of having folks go from their back to their side dates back to the Revolutionary War, when snoring was a problem with sleeping in close quarters, where they would actually command soldiers to tie cannonballs into the back of their sleep shirt, so that they were actually forced to kind of roll into their side. So these are problems that have been around for a very, very long time, and I wholeheartedly agree. Alcohol, from what I've seen in sedatives, can greatly increase the incidence of snoring and/or sleep apnea, but the newer ones seem to be doing real well.
Well, gentlemen, I wanted to thank you for taking time for being with us. Dr. Mark Amayawal, professor and chair of the Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis, also director of the Minnesota Regional Sleep Disorder Center. Captain Pete Mockelson, head and neck surgeon at Wilford Hall Medical Center at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. Thank you for taking time.
Thank you.
And hopefully you'll have a good night's sleep tonight.